Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Once again, the Market Basket saga dominated state headlines this week.
If they're coming in here, they're coming after our jobs. That's the bottom line right there. We want our jobs. And with the two co-CEOs they have in the company now, they're not doing us any good. They're here to destroy the company, and we don't want that.
Employees like Bill Shanahan, interviewed by the Nashua Telegraph, were pretty upset with the jobs fair the company held this week. In political news, candidates for state office are outlining their platforms in more detail. This week, Republican gubernatorial hopeful Walt Havenstein described his proposal for lowering state business taxes.
Even at our meager, meager, anemic growth rate, our growth rate will offset that particular reduction. Right? So rather than think about it as what are you going to cut, let's make sure we have fiscally conservative policies to make sure our spending is not exceeding our growth.
Meanwhile, New Hampshire members of Congress this week focused on legislation to combat sexual assault on college campuses. Here's 2nd District Democrat Anne McLean Custer.
And I think they deserve a voice and an advocate that will change that environment so that they can have healthy college experiences and effective and successful careers.
Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Join our conversation as we cover these and other stories. And we're going to start with Market Basket. So let's hear from you on that. How is this affecting your grocery shopping? How do you think this whole saga is going to end? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup include Kathleen Ronayne, Statehouse reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Kathleen, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, let's spend a little bit of time, folks, on the Market Basket shakeup. The week Dean started off with jobs fairs. Who were those aimed at and what happened?
Yeah, the current Market Basket management announced that they were going to have a job fair, I think 2 days for current employees who are interested in maybe switching jobs within the company, and then 1 day for people outside of the company. Not surprisingly, given the current environment, the job fairs were poorly attended. Now, the management had said, if you're concerned for your safety because there were these protests outside of the area where the fairs were taking place, you can email in your resume. So we don't really know what kind of email traffic they got on this, but in general, it seems like these job fairs were a bit of a bust. And now we have this circumstance where virtually all part-timers at Market Basket are losing their hours. Just there isn't enough customer traffic in order to justify having part-time people working. Now, the administration was quick to say that they're not being laid off, they're just not being given hours, but for all intents and purposes, they're not generating any income. So, I mean, this has really turned into a very pretty sad spectacle. You drive by any Market Basket and the parking lots are empty, and I think financially it's really starting to bite for people who need their jobs to make a living. And I think the figure I heard was something like potentially as many as 8,000 part-time Market Basket workers in New Hampshire. So that's a big problem for the company. That's a lot of out-of-work, unhappy, struggling individuals and families. And for me, this whole thing now has kind of raised two big questions. The first is how the current management thinks they can turn this around, to sort of change the kind of incredible negativity that the whole situation generated. You know, I think we've sort of passed a tipping point now. I don't know how the current management, given their tack, the tack that they're taking, turns this around. And the other question is, for the workers, you know, there was this report that the Belgian parent company of Hannaford has put in a bid for it. Are they going to be happy simply to have the current management and the that half of the Demoulas family, Arthur S., out of the picture, or do they have to have Arthur T. back in? And so, you know, how does the current management turn this around? I don't know that they can. And secondly, selling to some other third party, is that going to be enough to stop the current crisis for them?
Well, and Gary, another piece of news that just came out a day or so ago, the state of New Hampshire said some of these part-time workers who are not getting paychecks, even though they haven't officially been laid off, as Dean described, could get unemployment insurance. So a little relief there.
Some of them can, not all of them, obviously. There's a certain cutoff where you have to work so many hours before you can collect unemployment. But an awful lot of them can. And actually, that's a fairly new development because it didn't actually, you had to be a full-time worker not that long ago to collect unemployment. So that will be some help to them. And obviously, the governor, Maggie Hassan, checked in. She had put out a very strong statement about this whole situation. I mean, there's not a lot she can do about it, but except the attorney generals in both New Hampshire and in Massachusetts have warned them, you know, we do have certain labor laws that you're going to have to follow if you're going to try to replace all these people.
Well, and there are economic repercussions,
there
you know,
are.
With the workers and the suppliers
and
an
economic
farmers.
Repercussion also for all the businesses in New Hampshire, because if a lot of these people do get unemployment, you're going to put a huge draw on the state's trust fund. And then all of the state's businesses are going to have to pony up and put more money in.
Wow. Well, it's a story that just seems to get bigger and bigger every day. And we got a lot of comments on NHPR's Facebook page this week on this story. So I just want to share a couple of these comments with you all. Margaret says, "This amazes me and fills my heart to no end. Just incredible to see such passion by the employees and communities that made Market Basket what it is. All done without striking or labor union backing." Margaret says, "Come on, Arthur S., get the message and make a move before you lose everything," capitalized. Aaron says, "You forgot to mention the fact that customers attended the rally and have been a big force behind the boycott. It's the customers not shopping at Market Basket that have made the biggest impact." And here's another one that came in on NHPR's Facebook page. Joan says, "What changed at Market Basket since the change at the top other than their CEO? Did you lose your profit sharing, bonuses, vacations? It seems you will lose your jobs since your strike has had a high cost on the bottom line. You may all be unemployed." Joan says, "How many suppliers or independents have suffered because of your actions? Many will be losing their shirts due to your demands." So, Gary Reno, there's a little pushback from Joan saying, you know, hey, Market Basket associates, you know, this is partly your own fault if you're struggling.
Well, yes and no. I mean, this has been a battle that's been going on for a long time. And the lines have been drawn in the sand over and over again. And it finally exploded is finally what happened. And I mean, it's one PR disaster after another, and that's just the way it's been going.
All right. Well, thanks for those comments on NHPR's Facebook page. And you can comment on the Exchange's Facebook page, too, if you want, during the hour, our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can also give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. A couple other headlines that caught our attention on the Exchange this week. Kathleen Ronayne, help us out with this one. A couple political headaches for Governor Hassan. She had to give back a lot of campaign money, about $33 million, I think.
$33,000,
I'm sorry.
Wow, $33 million.
I'm thinking of the U.S. Senate campaign, which is a... that's a lot of money, though.
She has to give back, or she gave back on Monday. Her campaign gave back $33,000. $24,000 of it went to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union, and the other $9,000 went to the Plumbers and Steam Fitters Union. What's happening here, and I realize campaign finance is not a subject that excites a lot of people, but when you start talking about sending thousands of dollars back, that usually gets people's attention. There was a question of whether or not she was allowed to accept unlimited donations before she filed for office, what the threshold was, and there was a little bit of uncertainty about that. The Attorney General's office said last week that until you officially file, your candidate committee can accept unlimited donations from other political committees. So her campaign, they were right in what they were saying, that they were allowed to accept these big checks. But what happened is two of the checks actually came or were physically picked up, as her campaign says, the day after she filed. So that's why she has to give the money back. So their whole rationale for taking the money was allowed, but people were not careful about the actual rules. And now she has these headlines where she has to give $33,000 back. So they can say all they want, we were right, but somewhere along the line, somebody wasn't careful. And no, it doesn't look great when you have headlines that she has to give back $33,000. So I think that was a bit of a headache. Again, you know, campaign finance is something that's tricky to get voters to latch onto. So is this actually going to make a difference? Who knows? But we have seen Walt Havenstein come out, and he said that if he's elected governor, he will push the legislature to try and make these laws more clear. I mean, for years and years, the attorney general's office and has said, you know, these campaign finance laws are very unclear. We can interpret them for you, but if you want to stop having problems, you know, the legislature needs to get serious about making the laws clearer. So we'll see if anybody files a bill to do that in September.
Gary, you want to jump in?
Well, I think what's kind of interesting about this whole decision that Attorney General Joe Foster made is that basically it opens the door from the time somebody takes office till they file for candidacy for reelection to taking all kinds of money from various PACs. You set up your own PAC, and then you can take all this money from all kinds of PACs. I mean, it's like if you want to play, hey, here it is. Let's donate some money, and it'll be interesting to see how that affects politics in New Hampshire over the next few years.
So this shows some flaws or difficulties with the system.
And I mean, the whole issue is going to come back to the Citizens United. I mean, money is speech, and if you're trying to limit speech or limit money, you're going to have problems. And it's just opened things wide up in terms of the money matters.
Dean, real quick.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the way Gary's right, the way campaign finance decisions are going these days in the courts, it's going to err on the side of greater ability to give money rather than less. You know, this is an example, as Kathleen said, of the importance of legislative language. You know, this is a very specific situation, committee to committee. And as Gary said, it's an advantage to the incumbent who can, once elected, set up a PAC and just basically take in donations through the entire length of his or her term in office.
Go ahead, Kathleen. A quick thought from you there.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting to me about it, going off what Gary said, you know, money is speech, is everything behind Citizens United. But the rules now are in a situation where you can make unlimited donations till 11:59 the day you file, and then 2 minutes later, donations are illegal. So we're not just saying money is speech, we're time limiting like when you're allowed to make that unlimited speech through your money and when you're not.
Okay, and coming up, many of Governor Hassan's traditional supporters were pretty upset with her recent veto of a workplace bullying bill. We'll find out more on that in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Say, if you don't want to fix the latest thing to break down on your vehicle, well, then maybe it's time for you to donate it to NHPR. It's as easy as becoming a member. All you have to do is make a phone call. We'll fill out the paperwork and arrange for the pickup and sale of your vehicle. Just call 1-877-393-NHPR to get things started, or go online to nhpr.org. Partly to mostly sunny today. Slight chance of showers with an isolated thunderstorm this afternoon. High temperatures mid-70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. And Birchill Terrace, a not-for-profit continuing care retirement community offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care in Manchester. BirchHillTerrace.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we're covering some of the big stories that made headlines this week. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, I did want to turn to another issue that made news for Governor Hassan, and Kathleen, made some trouble for Governor Hassan. Many of her traditional supporters were pretty upset with the governor this week when she vetoed a workplace bullying bill. Actually, I think she vetoed it about a week ago, but there's been repercussions ever since. So can you just back up what this bill said, who it applies to?
Yeah, so basically this bill was something that they've been working on for 2 years now. I think it was first introduced in the first year of the session, but the Senate held on to it to work on it a little bit more. What this bill aim to do was to provide more protections against workplace bullying for state employees. So anyone who works, you know, for a state agency, et cetera. And it basically directed employers would have to come up with a, you know, a written policy for how people tackle issues of bullying, you know, the channels that it goes through, who's going to investigate it. The governor vetoed it because she thought that it was overly broad. And if, I mean, if you look at the language, it was, you know, everything from a boss asking you to do an unreasonable workload to, you know, a coworker being demeaning to you. I mean, it was the what Governor Hassan was saying is that she thought that this was trying to legislate politeness, and you might get into a situation where, you know, how do you decide what's an unreasonable workload? Maybe a boss asks you to do something that you don't want to do, and suddenly, you know, are you saying you're being bullied? So that's why she vetoed it. But the State Employees Association is really upset about it because if you talk to them, they feel that there is a very real problem with bullying. And I think they're, you know, they're not talking maybe somebody, you know, asks you to do a little work that you don't want to do, but a real problem. And I talked to Andy White as well. He's a state representative, chairman of the House Labor Committee, which took testimony on this bill. He said the same thing. This is a real problem. And I think that the veto message, they were hoping that the governor would put an executive order out as well, directing her agency heads or, you know, to form a commission to talk about how they're going to tackle this issue. And I think with her just vetoing the legislation and putting out a statement but not taking any other action, they're feeling like she doesn't take the problem seriously, that she's not doing anything to help. It felt like a blow off, and they're upset about it because they think it's a real problem. And it's going to be interesting what happens. I think that, you know, there could be enough votes to override the veto. We'll see if, you know, Democrats decide that they want to do that to the governor 2 months before the election.
Right.
But it passed both chambers on a voice vote, you know, which indicates that they're was broad support for it. So
sure, because the Senate's run by Republicans, so it must have some level of support.
Well, the lawmaker who support. called for the veto override was Sharon Carson, and she's a Republican. So both sides really wanted to see this bill go through, or at least wanted to see some type of action on the issue.
Dean, kind of surprising. Yeah. What do you think, especially so close to the election?
Well, in part, I was going to say, I think that's to some extent drove the decision, although I can't say definitively. You know, this particular bill dealt with state workers, but this is the kind of legislation that private employers and the state of businesses typically don't like. And, you know, Maggie Hassan, if you saw her recent campaign ad that just came out, is kind of staking her claim as kind of a bipartisan, you know, somewhat moderate, Republicans, independents, and Democrats all working together. And, you know, sometimes in an election, if you want to position yourself that way, you need to annoy some of your core traditional supporters. I mean, that's what you do when you sort of triangulate between your base and other voters in the party, so or outside of the party. So, you know, I mean, my speculation here is that while, you know, she may have been able to handle it in a way that might not have been so upsetting to the state employees union, this is the kind of legislation that a governor might veto in order to position his or herself as, you know, not only a champion of workers, but also creating a business-friendly environment. So I think there's probably a little bit of that going on precisely because we're heading into an election, which is maybe not be a little counterintuitive, but you often see that kind of behavior.
Again, our number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And in just a moment, we'll get an update on the Republican race for the gubernatorial nomination. Walt Havenstein and Andrew Hemingway have been making news this week. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. If you want to join us on that. Gary, one more headline concerning Governor Hassan. She had to once again call for a freeze on so-called large state spending. How surprising is this?
Well, the issue has been in the last 3 or 4 months is business taxes and interest and dividends taxes. They have been rather volatile. And at one point, they dropped off the table in March and April. And then they rebounded a little bit. But the July revenues came out the first month of the new fiscal year, and they were $33 million less than they were a year ago for July, largely due to the tobacco tax. If we remember, we were going to be facing a 10-cent increase in the tobacco tax last year at this time. And so all the wholesalers and so on bought up all the taxes, tax stamps before the tax went up so that they could save a lot of money. And what that did was obviously skewer the revenue numbers from last year to this year. About $28 million of the $33 million less is due to the tobacco tax.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard that explanation. That's really interesting. So the wholesalers of cigarettes have to buy a
tax
stamp
to put on cigarette packs. And they were buying them up before the tax went up so that they could put them on this, you know, in the future as it goes along, but they were saving themselves 10 cents in the tax.
When you're operating at a big level, 10 cents
becomes
means
quite a lot.
Right.
But the issue is really the business taxes and the interest and dividends taxes. And those were down again, not substantially because July is not a huge month for the business taxes, but it was down enough that she put out a statement saying she's calling back her revenue estimating panel back in to look at the trends. And in the meantime, not only do we have a hiring, equipment, and out-of-state travel freeze, if there are any large expenditures coming down the pike, you're not to spend the money until we get a better grip of what's going on.
Well, again, it's another less than flattering headline for the governor as we head into an election.
Well, it's an issue that we have some serious money problems, and they're not going away. And we have other problems that we're dealing with. It's going to be even making the next budget even more difficult, which is the MET or the Medicaid Enhancement Tax settlement with the hospitals and the mental health settlement that also is going to cost the state some money.
Well, speaking of government spending, this has been a big theme of the campaigns of the two Republican candidates for governor, Andrew Hemingway and Walt Havenstein. You can join us with your questions or comments on that. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So, Kathleen, as I said, Walt Havenstein and Andrew Hemingway gave more detail about their economic plans this week. Can you just briefly, Kathleen, summarize Havenstein's plan?
Yeah, so this week he put out – Hemingway's came out actually a few weeks ago, but Havenstein put his out this week. And the broad goal is if he's elected governor, he wants to create 25,000 – he wants the state to create 25 – well, employers in the state, not state government, to create 25,000 jobs by August 2017. And how – you know, there are many steps to doing it. One of the biggest things is he wants to cut the business profits tax from 8.4% to 7.5% or 8.5 to 7.4 over the course of 2 years. And that would actually bring in about 40, according to his calculations, about $49 million less into the state over 2 years. And, you know, the rationale behind it is that you lower that tax and you become more business friendly, you get more employers in, you get employers hiring more people.
Because we have relatively high business taxes in New Hampshire, right?
Compared to the other New England states, yeah, I think we're number two with the other New England states. And you often hear Republican politicians talking about how we're higher than Massachusetts. And, you know, they think that's ridiculous. So that is kind of the crux of his plan. But, you know, he's talking about a lot of other ideas, you know, finding ways to lower energy costs, finding ways to lower healthcare costs, getting rid of several regulations. And, you know, when he was talking about it on Tuesday, he set this date, this goal for when he wants to create these 25,000 jobs. And it actually, when he was at Sanders back in 1999, they did a similar initiative he talked about where they set a date, I think it was August 15th, 2000, where they that was their goal to develop this new fighter plane. And he said that having that goal that everyone could build around created this culture at the company where everybody, you know, was going in the same direction, knew what they were looking for. And so he's kind of trying to replicate that and use an idea that he's, you know, used before, that he's had some success with.
Sort of shared goals, shared
kind of
vision,
set, yeah, and,
shared
and
mantra.
He's saying, you know, it needs to be a cultural shift. One of the other things he proposes to do, which I think might be a little tricky. Every bill that would affect business regulations, taxes, business at all would have to have a jobs impact assessment on it, which is similar. He's thinking how anything that affects the budget would have like a fiscal note on it. So I think it'd be interesting to see how exactly that's going to work, how easy that is to determine how many jobs a piece of legislation would create. But again, it's part of his whole idea that, you know, you get the culture of state government centered around an environment where businesses want to create jobs. And that's just one piece of it. So that was the plan that he put out this week. And I think it's his first substantial policy plan that he's put out of this election cycle. I can't think of any others, whereas Hemingway's been, you know, rolling them out since he got in the race.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about his in a minute. Yeah. Here's an email that came in about Walt Havenstein. Tim in Durham says, it's ironic that Walt Havenstein is moralizing about government spending after making his fortune as an executive for defense contracting companies. His fortune was made almost entirely using taxpayer funds. Guessing that refers to Dean Spiliotis, Walt Havenstein's time at BAE Systems, which is a major government defense contractor.
Right. And Havenstein has come out on several occasions in the face of these criticisms. I believe one of the other companies that he was in charge of made millions of dollars with Obamacare contracts. So you know, he has said, look, the decisions I make as a CEO for my company don't necessarily translate directly to my positions as a politician. You know, it's interesting, as I talk to various politicians and Republican activists around the state, they're all really focused on the issue of the business climate here in the state. They all talk about the business profits tax, the business enterprise tax, and that you need to lower these taxes in order to have a more favorable climate for new businesses to grow here. As we'll talk about, Andrew Hemingway's proposal is a little more radical than Walt Havenstein. You know, my general take on Walt Havenstein is that he comes from a long tradition of new politicians who try to translate their experience in the private sector as a CEO into either running for governor or U.S. Senate. And they basically say, you know, I have these leadership skills from the private sector. I'm going to apply them to the governor's office. You know, Havenstein's initial problem was that his, you know, as he did this, he wasn't really able to go beyond the general narrative of I was a successful CEO. And, you know, we have the example of Craig Benson. That didn't go particularly well. So you need to kind of go a little bit beyond that. And Walt Havenstein ran into some initial problems where it was clear that his kind of grasp of the mechanics of state government in the state were not as strong as they should be. I think, as Kathleen said, he finally seems to be getting his act together in terms of actually coming out with some proposals that are designed to give us a better idea of where he wants to go. But, you know, as I've said on a number of occasions, simply saying that, you know, being a CEO translates into being a governor or a U.S. senator or what have you, it's not really the case. There is some transfer, but being a public official is just different than being a private CEO. And I often see these former CEOs who think it's going to be sort of an easy transition from one realm to the other, and it's not.
Yeah, and Dean, I know Gary wants to jump in, but I also want to ask you in a moment. Yeah. You interviewed Havenstein and Hemingway,
both Havenstein, right? And Hemingway. I've talked to both of them at length. Yes, and they're very different candidates. As I mentioned, you know, Walt comes out of this sort of I was a CEO approach. He's lined up a lot of the you know, kind of the big establishment players. Mitt Romney just endorsed him recently. Chris Christie has been up here several times campaigning for him. You know, he seems to be sort of the establishment pick just based on kind of financing and general fit. Andrew Hemingway, a lot of us know him as a younger political conservative activist in the state with some Tea Party and libertarian leanings. You know, my biggest concern for Andrew is that, and I saw this with Kevin Smith in 2010 when he was the head of Cornerstone Action, the conservative think tank who then ran for governor against Ovid LaMontagne, is making that transition from activist to politician or policymaker capable of governing in some sort of a bipartisan way. And he has not made that move yet. When you talk to him, he still sounds like a conservative activist, a very knowledgeable one who knows a lot about policy. But you still get to feel like he's sort of a kind of a hardcore activist. And it's very hard to get elected governor in this state from that approach.
Yeah. Gary, go ahead, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, Walt Havenstein has come out of the large company like BAE. And if you look at the business profits tax, that's largely a tax on large publicly held manufacturers. And that's why we had the BET, because most companies weren't paying any kind of business taxes in a state. So these are companies that really are not driven locally in terms of job creation. Job creation is driven from the higher level because they're multinational companies in a lot of ways. In talking about business environment and so on, the BET has a much more effect on the local businesses than the BPT does.
Because it targets more small businesses.
It's all small businesses, all the local businesses, whereas the BPT hits mainly the large multinational or national corporations that do business here.
All right. Again, join us as we talk about politics here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And thanks for that email, Tim. Let's go next to Ted in Manchester. Hi, Ted. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, Ted.
I'm calling about the anti-bullying bill that was vetoed. Unfortunately for me, I find that, in my opinion, to be a failure of the governor. This was something that was really needed. Working for the state, I've seen it run rampant over my 20 years of service. And having friends that work for the Department of Corrections, let's say, where staffing has become below critical, where people are being forced 5 days a week and are being told families and other issues are secondary, you got to be here. And if you're not here, and mind you, we're talking 5 days a week of being forced, we're going to discipline you, no matter what. So they're getting their livelihood threatened against them, families put aside because we've failed to staff them adequately, but it's being put on them like it's their fault.
Ted, what do you think about the governor's concern that, you know, the words unreasonable workload are highly subjective and could be abused?
Well, I mean, all I can tell you from my standpoint is an unreasonable workload, working an extra 40 hours a week. I mean, I guess you could say that's subjective, but I believe it is.
So 40 hours on top of your regular 40
on
hours.
On top of your regular 40
yeah,
hours.
Yeah, it's a lot of hours.
I mean, yeah.
As a state employee, Ted, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're heading into a break, though. As a state employee, how does this make you feel about, you know, getting out in the trenches and working for Governor Hassan this fall?
Actually, more than likely, she's lost my vote because of this. Actually, I was very disappointed in her. I voted for her last election, and more than likely, she won't have my vote again. And what that could mean is I may not like the other individual going, so I may not vote for them. But any vote not for her is a vote for the other person.
Okay. Ted, thank you very much for calling in. And coming up in just a moment, we'll talk a little bit more about state politics, including efforts at the congressional level to combat sexual assaults on college campuses. I got an email on that already. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Republican primaries are held in 5 states. Then negotiators work to bring about a longer peace between Israel and Hamas. And an insider attack kills a U.S. general in Afghanistan. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from ServiceLink, New Hampshire's Aging and Disability Resource Centers, home of SMP, helping seniors prevent Medicare fraud. Answers to your Medicare questions at 1-866-634-9412. And Center for Physical Therapy and Exercise, keeping the community in motion since 1989, providing warm water pool therapy at their Nashua Clinic. More information at cpte.net. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're talking right now about another element of politics as we head into the 2014 elections. And Dean Spiliotis, that's a lot of attention by New Hampshire's congressional delegation on the issue of sexual assault on college campuses. Why does it seem that every time I turn around, another member of our delegation is talking about this?
Well, I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of attention on this issue in recent months. Dartmouth had been in some national headlines for how their response to some issues on their own campus. So this is something that has gotten a lot of high visibility. I think people are talking about it as a problem more openly. Social media has helped to kind of raise the visibility of the problem. And that has brought in attention from our congressional delegation. And, you know, the issue has been, the complaints have been that, you know, colleges and universities are very loath to bring in police from the outside. They typically try to deal with it internally, and there's been some feeling that it's not really taken seriously. And this is a big issue. I mean, my entire time I've been in university life as a professor and formerly as a student, this is a recurring issue that you hear about. It's talked about. And there never seems like quite enough progress is made. So, you know, I think a lot of the universities are now starting to deal with this internally more effectively. But perhaps federal legislation will give some new leverage for people who want to address the issue. But it's been a problem, continues to be a problem, but at least it's finally getting more visibility.
Well, here's an email from Susan on this. She says, you mentioned in your opening that you'll be discussing the sexual assault issue on our college campuses. Susan says, my concern is that I've read the news coverage of this topic is the recent issue on the campus of Colby Sawyer College in New London. In that instance, the young women were harassed by local police. So Susan says the legislation also needs to protect victims on campus from sexual exploitation by anyone in authority, not just campus attackers. And, you know, Dean, we should mention, I mean, in the past anyway, sometimes there are stories of professors also, you know, doing things that are inappropriate with students. So Susan's calling for a widespread approach.
Right. And, you know, universities do, I mean, they have policies on the books for a lot of these issues, including the relationship between faculty and students and what the boundaries of that are. But the issue is kind of how the stuff is dealt with internally, you know, whether it's tried to be covered up. But for me, the bigger issue is kind of changing the culture so that people feel like if you do this, there will be consequences. Traditionally, the feeling has been that, you know, universities sort of try to either sweep it under the rug or just sort of keep it in-house, and that has not been good enough.
Do you want to jump in, Kathleen?
Yeah, I think I agree completely with Dean that it is a cultural shift, because I think that you can put as many laws or regulations in place as you want, but a lot of the reason that this is a problem is because young women on college campuses they're often afraid to report because they feel like if they do, it's not going to be taken seriously. There might be victim blaming that goes on. And a lot of the reason that happens is because several of these incidents deal with athletes. And we know that, you know, colleges don't want bad things to come to their athletic programs, which are big money makers. So you see a lot of the kind of victim blaming mentality happen. So I think that it's really crucial that colleges, administrators, you know, take it upon themselves to show students that they care about this issue and it matters to them, because if you're just putting more laws in place, you know, that doesn't necessarily make the issue more out in the open, and it doesn't give people that are victims the confidence they need to come forward and actually report what's happening.
Well, and to put a New Hampshire spin on this, UNH has gotten national recognition for its initiative from the White House, I think, even in this area. And Dartmouth has gotten some national criticism for its approach on this issue, although they did hold a whole summit on sexual assault about a month ago, so trying to tackle the issue there. Well, I want to turn from this very difficult topic to a happy story, one that definitely caught my attention this week. It's the story of two New Hampshire teenage bagpipers, pretty talented ones at that, to the point where they were planning on traveling to Scotland for an international bagpipe competition, but not before a little difficulty at the U.S.-Canadian border. With us now is Rick Stevens with the Associated Press of New Hampshire, who covered the story. Rick, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, it's a great story. And just back up, if you could, Rick. These two boys, Campbell Webster and Eric Bean, had gone to Canada to play in a sort of warm-up competition before the big event in Scotland. I read your coverage of this, Rick. So then what happened?
Well, as you said, Campbell and Eric were in Canada. They're quite accomplished pipers, and this was an international competition ahead of the World Games. They drove, because it's easier to drive than to fly, of course, but crossing the border at Highgate Springs, Vermont, they ran into a snag. There is a ban on importing anything containing ivory, at least ivory that has been harvested since 1976. And if you do not cross at a designated port, which Highgate Springs is not a designated port, you have to shell out some $575 or so in fees. And they didn't have these permits or fees, so their bagpipes, at least the ivory parts, were seized by Customs and Border Protection agents.
And the guys, the boys, were afraid of what would happen to their beloved instruments, obviously. So what did they do, Rick? Right? You wrote that they sort of took these instruments apart so that nobody else could run off with them, basically?
They did. They didn't want anybody to make a full set of pipes, so they took anything they could harvest. And these pipes, Campbell's father, Gordon Webster, was a piper in the he was the ninth sovereign piper to the Queen of England, Elizabeth II.
Wow.
This is some pretty high level stuff. And these world games that they're going to compete in next weekend in Glasgow, these attract pipers from all over the globe. So yeah, they're it's about a $10,000 musical instrument. And they wanted to safeguard their instruments. So they took them apart. Now, happy ending, they did get their instruments back in time to fly to Scotland. They're there now competing. They're going to spend a month there actually doing not only competitions but workshops. And, Laura, I also just literally a few moments ago got off the phone with the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is responsible for enforcing these rules. They are going to look at the policy. They say they do recognize that musicians have some special circumstances, and maybe the policy goes a little too far, although they're going to be very serious about enforcing the ivory ban.
Well, I think that New Hampshire's congressional delegation had to get involved, right? Senator Shaheen or Senator Ayotte, somebody had to help these guys out so they could get their bagpipes and play in this international competition. Right, Rick?
That's right. The delegation got involved. Change.org, which is an online petition service, they got involved. They had quickly over 3,000 signatures from all over the globe. The boys had offers of loaner instruments from manufacturers, from other players, from bagpipe societies. So there was really sort of this gathering around the issue and around the guys. And like we said, it did have a happy ending.
All right. Well, maybe you can update us next week, Rick, on what happens to them at this international competition in Scotland. That's really exciting. Thank you for being with us. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
That's Rick Stevens again with the Associated Press, updating us on two talented bagpipers from New Hampshire. They're now in Scotland, as we heard, playing in an international competition. A couple more stories that we do need to finish up, all of you. And Gary Reno, this is an important story to me personally because I love, love, love swimming in New Hampshire's beautiful lakes, ponds, and rivers. And some disappointing news this week.
Well, yes, there's some algae blooms that have been happening and they have closed some beaches, including Mount Sunapee State Park Beach on Lake Sunapee.
Oh, that's a big one.
Which is a
lots
big one.
Of tourists.
And ironically, it was also the same. They closed it the same weekend that the Craftsman's Fair opened, which is a huge event, and that's just across the street at the mountain. And also New London's Hospital Day, which brings in a lot of people into the area. So,
oh, my goodness. Talk about terrible timing.
Timing, yes.
Sure.
And then there are a couple others, Long Pond and Henniker and another place down in Plastow or Windham, I believe. This is a common problem in the summer. I mean, largely it's generated by fecal matter from ducks and various other waterfowl.
Geese. There are a lot of geese
around
lately.
And things like that. It also is caused by the runoff from fertilizer into the lakes. And it's all this nutrients in there. And it causes these plants to just bloom in this time of year. This is a particularly bad summer. Other summers haven't been quite so bad, but this one has. And you get this slimy stuff that just grows. And not only is it very uncomfortable to be swimming in it, it also causes skin irritation and nausea and so on.
Yeah.
And so they've been closing some of these beaches because of it.
Wow. Well, I didn't realize that it was Sunapee, and that is a huge, huge deal because that Craftsman Fair draws people from all over.
Yep.
All right. Well, another story, and this one is a little bit easier to deal with, Kathleen. Charity gaming got some new regulations this week. How come? What was the problem with charity gaming?
Yeah, there was basically a big, I don't know if study is the word, but they looked into the regulations around charity gaming, and they found that New Hampshire's charity gaming industry was just wildly unregulated.
Really?
I think that there were some consultants who came in that said they have not seen a system like this in any other state, something that's so unregulated. And, you know, we've talked a lot about expanded gambling and what type of, corruption, et cetera, that might bring if you talk to critics. And you heard a lot of people talking this session about the fact that, well, we already have gambling happening in our state. It's charity gambling, and it's really unregulated.
It's big business too, isn't it?
I mean, it really helps a lot of the charities out. And so a huge bill that passed this legislative session that puts many more regulations on charity gambling, tries to, you know, make sure that the money is going the right places. You know, there's appropriate enforcement of how things are running because it you know, there was no regulation on it. So I think the feeling was if we're, you know, regardless of where the money is going to, gambling is gambling. And we need to make sure that we're regulating this industry in the same way that we would regulate any other casino or gambling industry.
Gary, you want to jump in?
It came in. This whole issue came up when we were trying to come up with regulations for casino gambling after the whole thing went down last year. And the consultants that they hired, White Sands, from said, you know, you're so unregulated here and you have so few controls over this. You don't know what's being spent. You don't know if the charities are getting the 35% that they're supposed to get. And even more importantly, you don't even know if you're getting the taxes you're supposed to be getting out of these things. And so they put together this bill along that went to go along with the other charity casino gambling bill, but this one ended up passing. The other one didn't, obviously. But what they did say was, you know, you need to have the same assurances at these charitable casino gambling events as you would if in a commercial casino. These people need to be assured that this is an up and up and that they're not being taken for a ride.
Well, and if you're going to help support the Humane Society or whatever,
right.
You want that money to go to that cause.
And so what they did basically is said whatever we were planning to do for casino owners and so on, these people are also going to have to do. They're going to have to go through background checks. They're going to have to do more auditing. They're going to have to do a whole lot of things like that.
All right. A couple more questions on that, but I think I'll leave it for another roundup because I did want to ask you, Dean Spiliotis, just very briefly, to give us the latest on the Abby Hernandez story, who, to her family's immense relief, returned home to North Conway recently after 9 months of what may have been a kidnapping. That's the charge, anyway, against a man named Nathaniel Kibbe. What happened in this case this past week, Dean?
Well, we've been dealing with various evidentiary challenges. You know, this is all driven by the fact that the paperwork surrounding the arrest has been sealed by the judge. So the defense attorney, who I believe is a public defender, has no way to really know exactly why they are holding his client, who has said that for, you know, he says he's innocent, and we'll see if we have a trial. But so they were able to get a temporary stay to not have evidence removed from Mr. Kibbe's trailer and storage area next to the trailer temporarily. But now the state wants to move the actual trailer itself, the mobile home itself, and the storage container next door to protect it, to put it somewhere else where it can be protected, because they said we can't afford to have 24-hour security. And the defense has said, look, if the stuff is moved, it may damage potentially exculpatory evidence. So we don't want any of it moved. They've asked the judge to basically leave everything where it is. But then the issue is going to be who's going to pay for the expense of securing the site. So this is all about access to evidence for the defense. And they've, again, have made this motion to not have the state remove the trailer and the storage locker to some other place for security purposes.
Wow, so a big job moving these two, you know.
Yeah. And we're not quite into fall and winter yet, but at some point, you know, leaving it unguarded is a potential for vandalism.
Sure.
You know, the sort of the weather damage, et cetera, et cetera. So an interesting kind of tug of war between the prosecutors and the defense this week.
Well, next week on The Exchange, I just want to give you guys a sense of what we'll be looking at on the show. We're going to check in on New Hampshire's economy, including this issue that we talked about this hour, how healthy or unhealthy is New Hampshire's business climate? So an economic check-in to begin the week. And later on, something I'm really looking forward to, we're going to check in on chickens, the Granite State's growing backyard chicken movement, that is. So that, we're going to have some fun with that show. A lot of folks are doing this. How about you, Gary Rayner? What are you following next week?
Well, mostly the political scene. It's certainly heating up now that we're into August and we're getting down to the wire here. We just got a few weeks left to go before the primary. Largely, I mean, we have some great races out there in this U.S. Senate race. We have the U.S. The governor's race. We have races in the congressional districts. I mean, it's a lot going on.
September 9th is the primary.
Primary, and it's a lot going on. It's heating up.
Yeah, there's a busy primary in both first and second congressional districts.
Yeah, and some executive council seats and a couple of really hot Senate races.
Yeah, well, and in Concord, one of those, right, Kathleen, will be decided probably in the primary. Concord's a pretty Democratic town, a couple other towns in the seat as well. And there's two Democrats who are closely vying for that seat.
Yeah, it's a very interesting race. So we've got Dan Feltis, who worked for New Hampshire Legal Assistance, and Cass Ardinger. She's longtime Concord School Board member, led Concord School Board through the elementary schools project. It's been a really interesting race. You know, Dan has had some significant endorsements, as has Cass. They're going to be together in a few different venues debating each other. So I think there's one at NEC just a few days before the primary in Henniker between the two of them. So it is a very heavily Democratic district. So I think, you know, the challenge for them is how do they differentiate themselves on issues that overall they're probably pretty similar on, you know, showing their backgrounds to voters, seeing if people want, you know, someone from the school board or someone from legal assistance. So it's a very interesting race we'll be watching.
And again, this is a heavily Democratic district.
Yes.
So the thinking is, Kathleen, the winner of the Democratic primary has a pretty good chance of actually being the senator.
Very good
but there
chance.
Is a Republican running and there will be a race in November.
Yes.
Yeah. Dean, how about you? What are you going to be following next week?
Anytime you have a safe seat like that with an incumbent that retires, there's all this pent-up energy within the party underneath that individual. And we're seeing that spill out all over the Concord area right now. Tomorrow marks 1 month until the primary. There's a Republican gubernatorial debate at Franklin Pierce Tuesday night. So just a lot of politics going on. This is a great month to gear up if you're following state politics.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for taking some time out of your summer to come in. And Kathleen, you have a big trip coming up. So good luck and
yes,
hear about it when
you
get back.
I'm thinking I might want to go over to Scotland and see these bagpipers.
She's going to Ireland, so I was going to suggest you hop over to Scotland. Dean, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Sure thing, Laura.
And Gary, thank you as well.
You're welcome, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producer is Faith Mikesell. Our intern is Renee Taylor. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin by evaluating New Hampshire's economy. Then we look back 70 years since the famous Bretton Woods Agreement, signed at the Mount Washington Hotel. It established the U.S. dollar as the standard for global trade. And later we check in on the Granite State's backyard chicken movement, why it's growing, and how towns are responding. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from AAA Northern New England, trusted road service for over 100 years, providing personal insurance protection for all of your family's needs, insurance for your auto, home, and life, AAA.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Banks. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The White House considers bypassing Congress on plans to make it more difficult for companies to move overseas for lower taxes. President Obama signs into law a $16 billion measure aimed at overhauling the Veterans Administration. Primaries are held in 5 states. Elections generally favored establishment Republican incumbents. Bank of America and the Justice Department are closing in on a deal that would be the largest settlement in the history of corporate America. And James Brady, former White House press secretary to President Ronald Reagan and gun control advocate, dies at age 73. The domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup after this update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Pentagon says U.S. fighter jets have bombed artillery that was being used by Islamist militants against a city in northern Iraq. NPR's Tom Bowman says the action comes after President Obama authorized the use of airstrikes in Iraq yesterday.
As the president said, and as senior administration officials told us last night, they would take action if U.S. personnel or facilities were threatened. And that's apparently what happened in this case. The artillery fire was heading into Erbil, and they saw it as being a threat to U.S. personnel there. The consulate is there, as well as dozens of American military personnel. So they decided to take out this artillery piece.
NPR's Tom Bowman. The U.S. has also dropped relief supplies to some Iraqi civilians trapped on a mountaintop and besieged by Islamist militants. Israel says it has launched a series of airstrikes against Hamas targets in Gaza. As NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Jerusalem, the renewed strikes are in response to rocket fire from Gaza into southern Israel.
The renewed fighting between Hamas and Israel comes shortly after a fragile ceasefire between the two sides expired. Two rockets were fired from Gaza into southern Israel just moments after the truce ended, followed by at least another dozen. Most landed in fields. Israel says the rocket attacks were unexpected.